What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, you and I do like to dabble in American foreign policy because, well, you know, we're the ones who are supposed to be making the world safe for democracy, and we haven't been doing a terribly good job at that. And that's why we've got two podcasts in a row, a mini series, if you will, on what is going on with American foreign policy. And two people who are rather skeptical experts about what we've been undertaking. It's been too bold, too broad, and it has not been attaining the goals that we've been attempting to spread democracy around the world.
Well, I don't know. Not, and then you got the business end of it. We're going to wars or going into places because we want what they have. And if they don't cooperate, well, we help them cooperate.
Oh, gee, that seems like a very gentle nudge. More on that later, friends. But back to the news. Now, most Americans don't think of our government as an empire, John. But do you?
I think we're more towards like an empire. We're acting. We want everybody to be in the same World Bank. Like I said before, we're out trying to, you know, we need the oil, so we're going to go where the oil is, and we're going to take it no matter what, you know? So, yeah, I think we're kind of an empire.
So you think we are interventionists.
That's right.
And that we project ourselves through our commerce, through our military, even our culture. I mean, John, when you go around the world, American culture seems to predominate. It's our movies and our music. So America really does have its handprint just about everywhere.
It does, and sometimes not in a good way. A lot of stuff going on in our name that shouldn't be happening, but we don't hear about it.
Well, absolutely. Well, you are going to be hearing about it today on America Trends and in our next podcast. Ivan Eland is with us. He's from the Independent Institute. It's nice to see that somebody is thinking independently.
Yeah.
And he wrote a book years ago. He's written many books in the meantime. But I took him back to a book that he wrote several years ago called The Empire Has No Clothes, U.S. Foreign Policy Exposed. And I think we're going to delve into that topic of empire, not an empire. And what is an empire? And if we are we a good emperor of the world, John?
That's right. Are we on the dark side of the force?
Well, you know, we like to think of ourselves as the guys in the white hat coming in to save the day.
I mean,
that's always, and we did. In World War II, there's no question. We got in a little late, and maybe we could have gotten in sooner. I saw a movie recently, and it was one on Winston Churchill. And I've got to say that I was kind of shocked when he made a phone call when he first became prime minister to FDR. And FDR said, look, I'm going to try to get you some surplus goods. I'm going to try to get you things. But I'm really limited because I've got a lot of people here in the U.S.
Right. We were anti-war.
Yeah, we were isolationist.
Yeah, yeah.
And FDR had to train us that there was a threat looming. And of course, Pearl Harbor obviously, you know, expedited that. But having said that, America seems none too unwilling to get into any situation
now
today.
We're just everywhere. And, you know, you got to wonder, you know, and because it's a volunteer force, these guys are going in time and time again, you know, they're re-upping and going in, and it's got to wear on our military, too.
Well, it seems a bit mercenary in a way. But let's talk about American foreign policy in the context of whether it's been working in this post-Cold War period and what kind of handprint and footprint we put all over the globe and whether maybe there's another vision for what America could do in the world around us. And again, let's start with Ivan Eland. The Empire Has No Clothes on America Trends. Ivan Eland is with us, and he is a foreign policy expert at the Independent Institute. And Ivan, I've got you on America Trends today because I know you wrote the book several years ago, The Empire Has No Clothes, U.S. Foreign Policy Exposed. But given the fact that we're in this new era of what our president deems his nationalism, I really want to go back and ask you to reframe the arguments that you made in that book about the empire and ask you whether things have changed in any significant way since you wrote this.
Well, no, they haven't really changed since I wrote the book. However, I think the U.S. empire is really showing more signs of a decline than when I wrote the book. My basic thesis is that, you know, we were overextended during the Cold War, and we were able to get away with it because the other country that we were jousting with, the Soviet Union, was a decrepit communist power, and they were spending way too much on their defense and their empire that their economy couldn't handle. And then I looked at parallels with our own country. Of course, we have a much bigger economy, a much healthier economy since it's not communist, but nonetheless, imperial overextension has caused the ruin of many more empires than losing the empire because of war. The primary example, I think, are France and Britain. They were on both sides of winning both world wars, but all those wars taxed, those big wars and the small colonial wars they fought, taxed their budgets, and they, you know, ended up losing their empires, and it were shadows of what they once were. In our case, I think, you know, we have almost $22 trillion worth of debt, and we, as an example, as an absurd situation, we're borrowing money from China to subsidize the defense of our allies against China. So it's sort of a crazy type thing where we have all these our commitments actually increased after the Cold War simply because there was no power to restrain the United States, and we wanted to grab as much influence as we could. So we expanded NATO alliance eastward, trying to defend countries that will be very difficult to defend against the Soviet Union. We also strengthened alliances in the Middle East and East Asia. Now, of course, now we have a rising China and a rising India. And, you know, whether we'll be able to continue this is very questionable since our percentage of the world's GDP is declining and probably will decline to about 6%. Other countries are just growing faster than we are. And, you know, what we probably should do is willingly retract all these commitments and alliances and military bases and foreign interventions overseas and try to put more resources into our economy.
Is that what President Trump, I mean, when he was campaigning, he was talking about these entangling alliances and the fact that America was overextended. Now he's been talking about other countries paying their fair share. I have not heard him talk about taking these bases necessarily, though he has threatened in certain cases maybe to pull them off of the Korean Peninsula, whatever it may be. But has he really gone about that process? In fact, I think he increased the defense budget rather dramatically.
Yes, and also he has accelerated a lot of these wars in Afghanistan and in other anti-terrorism wars in at least 8 countries and maybe more because they don't tell us some of the countries that were fighting in the special forces or drones, etc. So he's actually expanding those wars, and those have really sucked the life out of, too, especially in Afghanistan. We've been there, you know, 17 years, and we lost the war a long time ago, but the military just won't. I think he would like to get out of there. He has some good instincts in foreign policy, but the problem is he has scaled back what he said, as you mentioned. First of all, he was going to, what good is NATO? Maybe we should get rid of it or whatever. And now he's down to the fact that, well, we're not getting good deals either on trade or in the alliances, and therefore other countries must pay more or must let us export more to their country. And I'm not sure that's the right answer, especially in the security realm, because if you keep these alliances, you're always going to have the free rider problem, which economists say about alliances. And since we're the big power, we are disadvantaged by that. No matter which channel you turn to, MSNBC or Fox, they're always saying, well, we must reassure our allies as if the alliances are very fixed and in time, and also that they're an end in themselves. Alliances are a means to security, right? So they're a means rather than an end. And also, you go back to the founding, George Washington cautioned against permanent alliances. Thomas Jefferson similarly cautioned against entangling alliances. So, and if we look at the example, say, let's say World War One, nobody wanted that war in Europe, but they all the big powers got dragged into it simply because they had these alliances. And we have even less need for alliances since we're not in the middle of Europe, a middle of a bunch of other potentially hostile countries. We're over here on the other side of the world. And so we have a very intrinsically good security situation, probably the best situation intrinsically of any great power in world history. And we're really not taking advantage of that. We used to up until, you know, probably World War One, when we didn't get involved in a lot of this stuff because we really didn't have to. And that's another point of my book, is we really ought to have our alliances and our foreign policy geared to our security rather than this globe girdling informal empire.
Well, do you believe that Europe, left to its own devices, would again become a hothouse for a world war, if in fact that's what Jim Mattis believes is the reason for NATO, apart from the expansion that you talk about? And we did another podcast with Michael O'Hanlon looking at that expansion of NATO. I don't think a lot of people have really fastened on to that. But is that a good reason for America to have bases in Germany and everywhere else, just to make sure that that is not the match that lights another world war?
Well, I think, you know, we've pushed the alliance so far forward. I mean, NATO in its time defended Western Europe, and when it did that, I think it did contribute to the security, especially in the first couple of decades after World War II. Of course, Eisenhower said, you know, if we have troops in Europe, when he was a general, he said this, if we have the, you know, troops in Europe in the future, like 10 years, we'll have failed. Well, of course, by his definition, we did fail because we kept this alliance and we still have it and we've expanded. There was absolutely no reason to expand it after the Cold War ended unless you wanted to make it a political talk shop and invite Russia and everybody in, which they could have done, I think. But clearly, it's still a hostile alliance to Russia, and we would not like somebody, say the Soviet Union, Russia, China, creating a hostile alliance and taking in Mexico right on our border.
Well, that's why we had the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, that was an alliance, but yes, they put in offensive missiles 90 miles an hour, 90 miles from our border. So yes, that we got very touchy about that. So that's a good example. But in relation to your question, I think we're in a much different world now. You know, we sort of distorted the fact that Germany was a problem in both world wars. Germany is certainly a problem in World War II with Hitler, but we don't go back and say, well, our history of foreign policy starts with Munich 1938. We can't appease anybody, or, you know, the aggression is going to snowball and we're going to have a conflagration. But if you went back a little further, it would probably have been a bad idea for Woodrow Wilson to get involved in World War One. Of course, the victors, including the United States, rubbed Germany's nose in it with war guilt by demanding the abdication of the Kaiser, opening and causing reparations and causing a bad hyperinflation in Germany and leading to Hitler. So I think we have to be careful of assuming that we need to stay in Europe. We now have the European Union, and I think I'm a big supporter of that because it's a security alliance first and a trading alliance and an economic alliance second. It was originally created by France to hug Germany so that it wouldn't do what Germany did in the Second World War. And I think we have that now. And so, you know, most of those European countries are fairly stable. They're at least as stable as the United States. And so they've had a good track record. So I don't think, you know, we're still sort of living in the past there as well, I think.
You trace back this whole concept of empire to the Spanish-American War leading up to the invasion of Iraq. And of course, we haven't won too many wars in this recent period, and yet we've been really extending our reach and where we decide to enter into a conflict. So tell us why the Spanish-American War was one of these very seminal moments in American history that I don't think a lot of people consider it to be.
Well, what happened was, you know, we had been preoccupied with our westward expansion. We closed the frontier after, you know, mopping up the Indians and putting them on reservations in 1890. The frontier was closed. So then we went overseas in search of monsters to destroy. And there was, you know, other countries were getting empires. And so we kind of got tempted. So there was a rebellion in Cuba, and we sent a warship down there to kind of intimidate the Spanish government, which this was still a Spanish colony at the time. And certainly there was some brutality on the part of the Spanish, but also the rebels weren't that clean either in their human rights conduct. But the ship, there was an explosion on the ship. And of course, even the chief naval person on the scene thought it was an accident. And this was confirmed only like probably 10 or 15 years ago that it was an accident. And but nonetheless, they used it as a pretext to grab Cuba and to grab the Philippines as well as Puerto Rico. And to they used the war to also annex Hawaii as a territory. So this was our first imperial war overseas. And it really led to interventions in the 1920s in Latin America. And then, of course, you know, we went even further when we got involved. Well, first of all, Woodrow Wilson got intervened in Mexico several times. And then, of course, we got involved in World War One, and we were off, and that caused World War Two. So we were kind of off to the races. And then after World War Two, instead of going back home like we did after World War One, you know, became an informal global empire. And that we still have that policy, even though the world has changed.
And when you recarved Mount Rushmore, you left Woodrow Wilson in a very dark place in terms of your ranking of presidents because of a lot of this.
Yeah, I think he was the worst president in U.S. history, because I say he ruined the 20th century, and then he's still working on the 21st, because our involvement in World War One was really... You know, we got, as I say, we really, and you don't find this in the history books, but if you look at the facts, I think we contributed to the rise of Hitler inadvertently. We didn't intend to, of course, but with that war. And I think that if we had let Germany win or them battle out to the a draw, this was not World War II Germany with Nazis. These were, it was a king, like they had a king like everybody else, and he was a bit of a bluster, but he actually tried to avoid war too. He made some diplomatic mistakes, but then Russia and France also are equally culpable for that war. So we dived into it, and the reason that we did was Wilson was an Anglophile, and he was clearly biased towards the English, but we really shouldn't have had a dog in the fight, because we claimed neutrality, but his Secretary of State resigned, William Jennings Bryan, by saying, you know, you're talking about us having rights for Americans to go on belligerent ships, you know, through war zones, and some of them are even carrying ammunition, and which is absurd. And on the other hand, you're not criticizing the British hunger blockade of Germany. So this was it was sort of a one-sided neutrality, and we had send a lot of loans to Britain, but not to France. We had shipped a lot of arms. So we had a lot of economic interests in the Allies winning the war, because we wanted to get paid back by those loans. So eventually we ended up jumping into the war. And there really wasn't much of a security threat, because both sides, by the time we got in there, we jumped in like almost 3 years after it started. And both sides were exhausted. And we did end up tipping it towards the Allies. And, of course, then they made the mistake of having this punitive peace and going against the tradition. After the Napoleonic Wars, the Congress of Vienna brought France, the aggressor in that war, back into the Community of Nations. And they had 100 years of relative peace up until World War One. Well, after World War One, they completely forgot about that and, you know, had this punitive peace. And so... And also, World War One was really the advent of big government. You know, in the United States, the federal government had been less than 5%, more like about 3% of the GDP. And then we started off on this track of big government, the government getting involved in the economy. And much of the New Deal expansion of government was modeled on the World War One penetration of the economy. So we became a much different country in World War One. And then, of course, World War Two, it just was bigger and better of everything that happened in World War One in the economy, and even more regulation and that sort of thing. And so our country really changed. We hit 45% of the GDP was government spending. And so, you know, that's been a high. But then, of course, it was sort of a ratchet because it never went back. It went down after World War II, but it was still quite high, relatively speaking, to our traditional level. So our whole society changed in these wars.
Well, how can we sustain
that we have were originated in the wars?
How can we sustain, quote unquote, an empire? And a lot of people listening might say, well, I don't think America is an empire. We're not an imperial force. And yet I have had interviews with people like John Perkins who talk about America's invisible hand and the way that our military is used to extend a lot of business interests around the world. As you point out, we have devoted such almost endless resource to bases and alliances and obligations around the world and extended that over time. And it's both conservatives and liberals when they've been running their foreign policy that have been doing it wholly contrary to the principles of our founding. So we bought into it, both parties and all philosophies. So what kind of empire are we?
Well, I think my book that we're an informal empire. We're not a formal empire like Britain, France, you know, the Roman Empire, et cetera. We're very sophisticated. We've created institutions which we run, like the IMF, the World Bank, which are also in decline. We have these bases. We have in these alliances, one-sided alliances. And Trump, I think, is right. Like, what do we get out of these? We've subsidized the security of all these countries, and they really haven't given us a lot in trade. You know, they haven't opened their markets, et cetera. But, of course, my solution is more radical than his. I don't want to get a better deal. I just don't want a deal. I think we should really evaluate some of these troop deployments, the alliances, the military interventions. And I think it's even more imperative because after Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, countries pretty much know how to fight the U.S. You're not going to get into a battle with us with a conventional military war. What you're going to do is use guerrilla tactics and that sort of thing. And we haven't really had a good record on counterinsurgency warfare, but other countries haven't either. It's a great equalizer of poor countries and rich countries for them to fight us in a guerrilla manner. Now, it takes a long time. But, you know, usually they live in these places and they're like the Vietnamese, you know, they battled many imperial powers and the U.S. was the last, finally got their independence. But, you know, they believe that we're the same as the French, same as the Japanese, et cetera. And so a lot of these places that we're in, they conceive of us as an imperial power, and they don't make any distinction from the formal or the informal. But we do have a lot of informal tentacles that have gone around the world and that are very costly to us. And I also think it has driven our Social Security and system and all the entitlements that we have were rooted in Civil War pensions and even before that. And so, you know, war has created a lot of domestic programs here that are bloated as well. And I think we need to figure all those costs in as well. But we do have an informal empire, certainly of bases, alliances, and military interventions. And there's no doubt about that. But I think it's waning because we just don't have the money for it.
Yeah, what about debt? I mean, what is the implication? I mean, you say that we're $22 trillion in debt. We've had Lawrence Kotlikoff on from BU who said if you look at our public obligations and our obligations for these social programs or Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, everybody born today based upon our tax revenue projections, we're really $200 trillion in the hole and frankly worse off than Greece.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. I'm just talking about the stated public debt, but he's right. We have this big mound of entitlements coming due, and people, the baby boomers, are retiring, and then we've got all these other programs. So I wouldn't doubt that his figure is correct. So it's staggering. But I think, you know, we really have to, we need to stop digging the hole and at least, not dig it deeper. And, it is a problem, and we just can't afford it. After World War II, we had 50% of the world's GDP, and we're probably going to go down to about 6% in the next decade. So
why have we not accommodated to that? In other words, we were the only superpower that didn't, really have its territory hit. And similarly, we were the only superpower when Russia dissolved into, these various federated states. What did we do wrong at those moments in time where we could have said, okay, now we're pulling back, we're retracting? Instead, we've stayed out there and we've exposed ourselves more and indebted ourselves even further in this mire.
Right. I think right after World War II, Western Europe was devastated. And of course, we were a little nervous about the Soviets because they still had a big tank army that they might, come further. But it was kind of a stretch because the Russians lost 27 million people and had their own country in even more rubble than the Western side of the continent that we were dividing. But nonetheless, if you wanted to a hedge, we could have stayed over there for a while. And then after, about in the 1960, when all the 15 years after the war, the European economies had rebounded, we should have gradually, phased our participation there down. And then after the Cold War, I just don't see any reason why we just couldn't have come home, really, because you have the European Union. They could have, if they wanted to defend some, we've always technically encouraged Europeans to do that, but in reality, behind the scenes, we've said no, we don't want anything to interfere with NATO, and of course NATO, where we're in charge. So we could have said we're going to go home, and you guys are rich now, and you can create your own defense arm.
But we didn't do that.
Points, I think we could have done something different.
Ivan Elin, you are the author of The Empire Has No Clothes: U.S. Foreign Policy Exposed. So how do we get dressed again? How do we really begin to disassemble some of what we have built in response to changes, both politically, economically, and as it relates to our own limitations?
Well, I think, Trump is on the right. He's got the right instincts. But I think, unfortunately, I think, depending on what happens with this presidency, unfortunately, some of what he said was true, but it will probably get buried and discredited with other things that happen. But if that doesn't happen, perhaps, he'll start the move towards reexamining some of this. But the foreign policy elite of this country, they just don't want to examine the facts. They always use this U.S. leadership. We have to lead because this is the American exceptionalism. And I'd say we are an exceptional country. We have an exceptional government system and everything. But there's no reason that we have to use military force to try to take that overseas. It didn't really work in Iraq, and it really hasn't worked for most of the democracy-promoting invasions that we've done. Only four times in 18 since 1900 has it worked. That's a pretty abysmal record. So first of all, we need to stop doing things that don't work, and we can be an example to the world. And we're exceptional in another way. We're exceptional in the amount of debt that we have for a superpower that we have accumulated. And so, you can't really be a successful empire if you're that far in debt. It's just not going to work. Other countries can pull strings against your debt. And so I think we need to, start pulling back from some of these alliances. And it's going to be going to hurt, but I think Trump has started us on that road, and it depends on what happens with his presidency. But I think even if he does crash and burn in his presidency or doesn't get reelected or something, I think the handwriting is sort of on the wall because we just don't have the resources and we're not economically as dominant as we once were.
I heard Richard Haass, who is one of these more conventional foreign policy thinkers, and he said that America alone which was how he was attributing this new philosophy of nationalism as espoused by the president, means America last. Where should America be leading? I mean, if not with a cutting edge and forward edge of our troops, in what way should America's exceptionalism be made, you know, prominent on the world stage?
Well, I think we can be an example. I mean, people do emulate the examples of rich, prosperous countries, and we're still a rich, prosperous country. But I think we have a great governmental structure. I think we need to probably do some maintenance and repair on that. But nonetheless, our system is still better than dictatorships and you know, remnants of communist regimes that are still around here and there. So I think we can showcase that. And, you know, our definition of leadership is military power, and that's a pretty limited vision. I think really all power, really cultural, military, economic influence, they all are based on how healthy your economy is and how wealthy your economy is. And I think we need to work on that. And that means cutting entitlements. It means cutting the defense budget. It means cutting everything. I was the only fan in Washington of the sequestration, because I think you really have to have a decision rule, like an economist would say. You know, otherwise you get into log rolling and everybody votes to save everybody else's programs. You just need to draw a straight line and say, I cut X amount from every account in the budget, no exceptions, entitlements are going to be in there, defense is going to be in there, everything. We just have to reduce the size of the government, and we have to deregulate. That's one thing I think Trump has been trying to do that's laudable. And I also think if he rethought the problem and said, well, maybe we ought to start saying, do we really need these alliances anymore, and can we support them?
The former commander of the U.S. Army in Europe recently said that he thinks U.S. will be at war with China in 15 years. Are we on a collision course with the Chinese?
Well, we don't have to be. You know, most empires have run into problems with rising powers, and only four examples of peaceful coexistence have occurred. But I think with China, we could have that peaceful coexistence. But the problem is usually with the status quo power, the one that's on top, and that's the United States at the current time. They usually can't get over the fact, and their foreign policy elite can't get over the fact that the expectations should change because the reality has changed. Now, the British were able to let the U.S. rise in the late 1800s. And one of the reasons that they were able to do that is because we had a whole ocean between us. We didn't have the same problem before World War I, where the British and the Germans were sort of in close proximity, especially their navies, and that caused a problem. But we have an even bigger ocean separating China. Now, we didn't go to war with the Soviet Union, and that was primarily because of nuclear weapons, and we also had that second factor with China. They have nuclear weapons as well, so you know, if we get to go to war with China, it will be for reasons, you know, not really justifying the war. And we have to remember that that war could end up in nuclear holocaust. So I think, you know, what business is it of ours, really, if what the Chinese do with the South China Sea? Let the other countries in the region who are aggrieved by that, they can push back, really. If we reconceptualize our role and say, listen, China wants to be at least a regional power, so let's let them do that. They, you know, don't even let Russia have a sphere of influence. You know, sphere of influence is their taboo because we're in the 21st century now. But they're really not taboo because countries still want a security buffer around them. We have the Monroe Doctrine in the entire Western Hemisphere, but we won't allow Russia to have a sphere of influence around traditional invasion routes of Poland and Ukraine, and we don't allow China to have any sort of sphere of influence in East Asia. And if we get over that mentality and we pull back, you know, we can still have a place in the Pacific. We have Hawaii, Guam, Midway Island, etc. So we can keep forces there, but do we really need to be up in Japan, South Korea, Australia, right up slapped in the face of China? I don't think so. And I think, you know, the ocean, the big ocean between us and also nuclear weapons, I'm more optimistic about not going to war with China if we manage it correctly. But we have to manage our own expectations first. You know, somebody said, Gandhi said something to the effect of be the change you want to see, right? And I think we have to start with ourselves.
Well, let me ask you in closing, and Ivan Elin, you've been very generous with your time. He's written so many books about foreign policy and military activity, and we went back to The Empire Has No Clothes. Are we a force for good around the world today, or do we get ourselves into some nettlesome situations that are really difficult and often bring about a lot of unintended consequences? How would you typify America's position in the world?
Well, I think we've had a good effect on spreading, you know, free markets and free trade and that sort of thing up until, of course, Trump came along, when we're now retrenching on that. And so a lot of the post-war prosperity, I think, for Europe, U.S., and other developed countries has been, we've been a good force for that. So our policy is not totally, you know, bad, but I do think recently we've had problems. In Afghanistan, we helped, you know, support the radical Mujahideen during the 80s under Carter and Reagan, and it turned into al-Qaeda, the one of the worst threats to our homeland since War of 1812, right? And so that was bad. Then we went to Iraq for no reason after 9/11 and created what is now ISIS. You know, they came out and fought the invader, and they got really radicalized. So lately, we've had some counterproductive foreign policy. It mainly has to do with excessive military interventions and that sort of thing. And I really don't think we really think through these places, like we're in a lot of the countries in Africa now doing counterterrorism. A lot of those terrorists are not after the United States, and we probably should just let them lie. We don't have to save the world anymore because it just draws enemies here to the homeland, as we saw in 9/11. Bin Laden was the reason he was fighting the U.S. was because we were intervening in the Middle East and killing Muslims there and occupying what he felt was occupying Saudi Arabia. Now, certainly, you don't have to agree with what he did. He killed innocent people, which is abominable. But you have to go back to the reasons for some of these. People don't like the intervention, and there is blowback to the empire. And I think in our military policy, if we were more restrained and that sort of thing, would be good. I don't see any problem with the free trade economics and organizations that we built after World War II. But even those are fading as China comes on. But I think we should have let China into some of these organizations, let them have a big say, because they do have a big... We have to make room for other countries in organizations and let them have a sphere of influence and that sort of thing. I think we probably should go back to the four policemen concept of FDR, and that is... the big powers each police their own region, and then if there are other issues, you can bring them to the UN Security Council and let the powers. It will be five powers now, you know, in the UN Security Council. I think that might be the way to police the world.
Ivan Elin from the Independent Institute, I thank you so much for joining us today. Is there any place on social media that you'd like people to follow you and find you and your writings?
Well, our website is www.independent.org.
All right. I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you.